chance to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners. And really all of those folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you? I'm glad you're listening today. Today on the show, I have a really cool talk with a man named John Reed. And John is the owner of Red Beard Historic Bakery in Australia. That's right, in Victoria Province in Australia, just outside of Melbourne. And he uses a Scotch oven, an ancient Scotch oven, or at least a very old one. And it just sounds remarkable, all the things that he's doing. And he's starting a conference, and he's just doing all kinds of amazing things. So I'm really excited about this talk, and I know you will be too, to hear about what's going on down under. So before that, I have to say, if I sound energetic today, I'm kind of faking it, because I just got back from the airport, and Cindy and I dropped our daughter Robin off at the airport because she is taking off to live in England for a year or possibly 2 years teaching school out there. And it's the first time she's left home for something like this, and we're really, really sad. But it's a good thing. It's a remarkable time that we live in where your kid in Saskatchewan can hop on a plane and go, you know, all the way to England and get a job out there and teach school in the city of Canterbury and basically start her own adventure in life. So I'm very proud and really, really sad at the same time. But there you go. That wheel of life, eh, just keeps on rolling. So what else is going on with you folks? I've been hearing about super hot temperatures out on the East Coast and in Europe, and I hope you're all hanging in there. I actually saw a post today from Karina at Great Lakes Baking Company in Ohio. She had a picture of fall leaves out, said, oh, we have a cool day, and that means fall's got to be coming soon. And in a way, thank goodness, because it's been really, really hot. So I hope you're hanging in. I hope you're making do, for sure. So why don't we just get on to the chat, because it's a really good one. I met John indirectly through Joe Fitzmaurice in Ireland, and I met Joe through Sheena Howdle, who was from British Columbia but was living out in England, and met Joe. And I met Sheena through Bryn at Night Oven Bakery in Saskatoon. And so indirectly from my desk in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, through connection and baker connection and baker connection, I met up with John Reed, and I learned an amazing story about what he's doing out in southern Australia in a little town just outside of Melbourne. So let's talk to John. That's good. So let's see, Thursday morning there, right?
Yep, 9 o'clock Thursday morning.
Yeah. And so what's the plan for you today? Is it a big bake day or?
No, Thursday is an ad meeting day for me. So yeah, so it's a perfect day for me in terms of just being able to, be able to talk. So yeah, it's easy. Yeah,
awesome. Yeah. Well, so how does the historic nature of the bakery work? Like Red Beard Historic Bakery. Is it a sort of full-time bakery, or is it more of like a demonstration space?
So the historic thing is because we've got a beautiful old historic oven in there. So that's the historic thing. So it's been a bakery since 1881.
Wow.
The oven was built then, and it's been basically being baked in that oven for almost that entire time, with a small hiatus in the 1980s and 1990s.
Yeah. Wow! Yeah,
yeah.
So cool. I was reading that on your site about how that style of oven, like the Scotch oven, was
ubiquitous,
common throughout Australia or the southern Australia with the Scottish folks coming and settling and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I'd imagine in you know, wherever the Scots and the English went in Canada as well. So I imagine, you know, wherever the main settlements areas were, I guess, on the east coast, I imagine they were. You'll find Scotch ovens everywhere the English went, like you'd find in Quebec and, you know, the French-speaking parts of Canada, you'd find Goulard ovens. Yeah,
for sure. Well, I remember I was out in at the Fortress of Louisbourg out on Cape Breton Island in Nova Scotia, and they didn't have a Scotch oven, but they were baking bread in an ancient wood-fired oven that they had excavated and got back in shape, and it was pretty wild. This was before I opened my bakery, but I was still pretty heavy into it, and I was annoyingly upfront for the entire demonstration. It was so cool. Well, and I saw pictures of yours on your website with somebody checking the arch out by climbing all the way into the back of the thing. I have to say that scared the heck out of me. Like, it shouldn't, but it's kind of like caving, right? It's sort of like, you know, it shouldn't terrify you, but it did. I just saw that thing and I looked away really quick.
Well, they do collapse. That does happen. You know, eventually, you know, the dome will collapse. You know that as you're crawling in there, you know that will happen one day. And so it's always me who does it. So I usually don't let any of the other staff do it, because if it's going to happen that day, and you know that, you know, there could be worse ways to go as well, I figure. So, you know, if I'm unlucky enough for it to happen on that day, I do feel a little bit, particularly when I did it for the first time, I do it every year, you know, to check the oven out. But, yeah, that first time was scary.
Well, how big is the internal dimensions of that?
So it's 12 foot by 12 foot, or, you know, in metric, it's obviously, 4 meters by 4 meters, something like that.
My goodness. Yeah. That's wild. That's
yeah, and that was that's a standard size one. So that's it's called a full Scotch. And then there's a half Scotch, which is 10 foot by 10 foot internal.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's pretty wild. Like, I don't know if you know, I built an Alan Scott oven, but the slightly larger than home baker sized, right? So it's, you know, 4 feet by 3.5. And so the thought of 12 by 12, just I got to come see you load that thing one day, just to, like, that's got to take a while just to get everything in there. Is it one of those?
It does. It's one of those things, I guess, in your apprenticeship back in the day when they were, you know, ubiquitous everywhere, one of the things you would have been taught is how to manage that, you know, in terms of firing, you know, in terms of getting the temperature right, because there's no on-off button, of course.
Right.
So, but also just in terms of, you know, how to load and unload, you know, without burning things at the back, or, oven management would have been a large part of the apprenticeship, I imagine.
Yeah, no doubt. And with the Scotch oven being sort of indirectly heated, with a separate firebox, I guess.
Well, I don't know if you call it indirect. I think you have to call it direct, because unlike a Goulard oven where, you know, you've got the schnorkel, you know, which focuses the heat, and you've got the fire below, you know, and not actually in the oven. With the Scotch oven, if you looked at some of the videos or photographs, you've actually got the fire is on a grate that is in an alcove on the side of the main oven deck.
Right.
So you've actually got the flames going directly into the oven.
Oh, okay.
You've got the flue on the other side. So, you know, the heat circulates through
Right. Yeah, but because it's on
really, it's, I mean, it's very, very much like an Alan Scott oven. You know,
yeah.
I've built five, six, maybe almost seven Alan Scott ovens over the time since I first built an oven with Alan, you know, back in the, you know, I don't know, back in the early 90s or something maybe.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah, I built a number of Alan's ovens and, yeah, actually I'm not sure what I was going to, the point I was going to make there, but he based that, you know, in discussion with him, he based that basically around a Roman oven. So,
oh, okay.
So that the fire is built in the middle of the floor of the oven,
yeah.
And there's no firebox as such. So,
right.
That, you know, that my Scotch oven is basically a Roman oven to all intents and purposes. It's a Roman oven, but you know, the engineers. So you had the Enlightenment, you know, before they finally changed the design of the Roman oven. So you had engineers and scientists rethinking everything. And of course, one of the things they rethought was, you know, well, these crappy old Roman ovens, surely we can do this better. And so all they managed to do, though, was take the fire from the center of the floor of the oven and pop it on the side.
Okay.
Over a grate. So yeah. That it could breathe better. I mean, you know that from using Alan Scott ovens. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, they don't – it takes a while to get the damn things going. You have to stack the wood in a really careful fashion. So the flaming thing, particularly in winter, you know, if it's cold, it takes a while to ignite and get going, whereas the Scotch oven, it's wonderful. You've got the fire sitting on a grate and you immediately get a huge amount of oxygen because you leave the door below, the ash box door open, and you get this massive – amount of fresh air going up through the fire, and you get the furnace effect. So
right.
you get a much hotter, faster, better burn. So that's the one thing that the engineers could come up with to improve on the Roman oven. But essentially, it's still a Roman oven.
I gotcha. Yeah, but I can see how it. I can totally get how that's an improvement. You know, just in that, and even while in. Clean up because you've got the grate and stuff as well, right? So you've got easier to clean, but just the draw, because you're exactly right. Like when I'm setting my wood to do the first firing of the oven, it's, you know, wind direction and positioning of everything, so it's going to draw properly at the start is a big deal. That first, for me, like the first 20 minutes is very, very close attention, and then you're good, you know. But neat.
Yeah
that's so neat. Well, thanks for the explanation, because I did misunderstand. I thought of it as an indirect fire or firebox, but I like how you've described it. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, good.
Yeah so what, man? Well, so I don't know. So you've got I want to learn about the bakery, but then you're saying you're building ovens with Alan even before that. Like, so how did you get involved in this craft? Like, that start for you?
Yeah, so that goes back to I've been working in publishing for many years. So okay. I've had a couple of different, like all bakers, it takes, well, not all bakers, some people manage to fall into it immediately, you know, and I guess this is like for all crafts and professions, that, you know, that where there's a real calling. I don't know if that's all. I don't think that's all jobs, but for things where you actually get really, you know, where you get called, you know, I think, you don't necessarily stumble on it straight away. So.
Right.
For me, it started, I got offered a job, as a publisher. So it was a big career, step for me. I got offered a job as a publisher in Hong Kong, working for a large educational publishing firm based in Hong Kong. And, I just married my girlfriend, and we were thinking about starting a family at that stage. So we were really keen to go to Hong Kong and have this, you know, wonderful career opportunity for me. But it meant uprooting everything, and it meant at the end of the day, we sat down and had that conversation about, you know, well, what are we going to do about kids? Are we, you know, we'd been together for, you know, probably almost 8 years at that point. So, and we'd been skirting around the conversation and putting it off because there's never a good time to have kids, of course. But we were keen, and we got to that conversation where it was, well, we actually, we want to do kids soon. We kind of don't want to keep it off, you know, putting it off. We were both getting older. I was basically at the end of my 20s, just right, about to turn 30. And, yeah, we had that conversation, whereas, you know, there's no way we're going to bring kids up into the world in Hong Kong, of all places on earth. That's not where you want, from our point of view, that's not sure, where we see raising kids in Hong Kong. It's not going to be ideal in any way for you know, for bringing kids into the world. So we reluctantly, I because I'd accepted the job and I had the plane tickets, and you know, we were on our way to Hong Kong, and then we actually had to pull the pin. Like, you know, I think it was like 3 weeks out from actually going.
Oh, wow.
It was like a really bad move professionally for me to be saying no at the 11th hour. But yeah, I pulled the pin and basically said, well, you know, okay, well, this having kids thing and becoming a father, I've got to think about how I want to do this. And it just, you know, it was that just one conversation that made all the dominoes fall. So that led to conversations about, well, what is, you know, what is being a good father? You know, obviously working in publishing, I was doing a 60, 70 hour week. And I was, you know, working my ass off to try and, you know, make it into a career.
Yeah.
And, So I started reflecting on, well, what sort of job does allow you to be a good father? And that led to me basically getting out of publishing altogether. So I basically said, well, I don't think this is the job that actually will allow me to be a decent father. So I ended up, within a month or so, I got a job in a florist.
Yeah.
I'd never worked in that area before. I've got a degree in botany, so I know a little bit about plants.
Oh, okay. But, all right.
But you know, it was just a time for me to do something totally different and reflect on what I actually wanted to do next with my life. So while I was working at the florist, I ended up a neighbor invited me to come and help him at a local bakery near where we lived, that had, you know, one of these beautiful old Scotch ovens, Scotch ovens. And they were really caught out. They were short-staffed going into Easter bun time, and that's really big in Australia. Easter buns are, like, you know, insanely, you know, that's where all bakers sort of end up, you know, doing 24-hour days in the weeks and even months now, sadly. You know, we actually start doing Easter buns in some of the supermarkets now. They're coming out just after Christmas. So, So he said, look, we're really short staffed. We, you know, would you want to come, you know, and do a shift or two and see if you might want to do some baking leading up to Easter? So I'd always been interested in what he did, and his dad owned the bakery. So I went up there and did a shift, and that was the moment, you know. Within a week of working there, I'd realized that actually this was incredibly special. They were doing sourdough, they were doing it in a wood-fired oven. So my first exposure to baking was, straight to the heart of what really good baking could be. They were using wholemeal flours and wholemeal pastry. And so I was just incredibly lucky, I guess, to go there. And look, the really big light bulb moment for me was that moment when, standing around the shaping table with, you know, four or five other men and women, just chewing the fat talking about whatever, religion, politics, girlfriends, boyfriends, you know, just talking about whatever came up in the conversation for the entire, you know, sort of 8, 9, 10 hour shift, without let, basically, just chewing the fat, you know. I just realized, look, these guys have got it so good, you know. Yes, the boss, you know, has their hands, you know, and their bodies, yep. but not their head, and not their thoughts, not their dreams, not, you know, you don't. You know, my entire time and every other job I've had, including all the publishing jobs, the only chance I got to actually know the people I worked with was if I stole 5 or 10 minutes, you know, in the tea room.
Yeah.
You know, I'd find out, I'd ask, oh, how are your kids, and, what's happening and stuff, and I'd feel guilty if it was more than 5 minutes, and I'd be back to my cubicle in front of the computer on the phone, doing my job. And I guess the other time was at the Christmas party. Once a year, you get to know your colleagues and what they, you know, what their lives were about. But apart from that, you know, or maybe Friday after work, you'd have a drink down the pub. But, you know, the contrast to that, you know, people who had, you know, I worked with a tie, you know, a suit and a tie in that, particularly in the publishing area. And I was, you know, the tie was a garrote, you know, it was the noose around, you know, my neck, which basically, you know, the shackle that enslaved me to, you know, the corporation, the business, you know, and my thoughts were not mine, you know, they also belonged to the company. So for me, finding baking was just this amazing revelation that you could actually have a job where you could actually get to know your work colleagues and talk about, you know, solve the problems of the world around the shaping table.
That's fascinating. And that's really profound, you know, and very, very true now that I think of it, because that's exactly right. Like when I was baking, like when we had our bakery, the team, we built several teams over the years, but they were always so tight, you know, like everybody knew what everyone was doing that was good or bad or struggling, family histories, and, you know, telling old stories and stuff. And you could do that, you know, for several hours a day while you're doing your best work. You know, that's really, really cool. I've never thought of it like that before, but it's very true, you know, and you're exactly right about the alternative. Like when I was working in the corporate world, it was, it was like a coffee break or take the odd lunch or something like that, but you'd never really knew, you know, that much about the people that you were working with, you know, or you had to be a very outgoing person to know it, you know, whereas baking, I'd train even the folks that didn't last, we seemed to know an awful lot about them in the couple of weeks that they were with us, you know? So, that's really cool. So how long were you working there in that, like before you started with Redbeard?
So I was at that bakery, and it's a very iconic, famous bakery in Melbourne, Australia. It's the bakery that was started by two guys. One guy wrote a fairly famous book in the sourdough world. The bakery was called Natural Tucker.
Okay.
And the John Downs was the guy that wrote the Natural Tucker bread book, and that in Australia is like a fundamental moment in the rediscovery of sourdough in Australia. So we've always, like all English speaking cultures, you know, pre-1900, just about, you know, every bakery was, you know, a sourdough bakery. We didn't call it sourdough back in the day, we just called it bread, of course. But right. If you were lucky to live near a brewery, you could actually get some brewer's yeast, but most of the bakers in Australia were more isolated and had no access to fresh yeast, so they had their own leaven, their own wort going in the back of the bakery, you know, like the bakery in Trentham, you know, pre the railway access, pre 1920, there was no easy way to get hold of, you know, brewer's yeast, fresh yeast, so it was all sourdough. Yeah. And yeah. So that bakery that was started by John Downs and Dave Brown is still in the minds of, you know, the rediscovery of traditional baking in Australia. That's seen as ground zero.
Right. You know,
that's everything sprung from there in Australia.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's so cool that you got that you had the connection to get in there for sure.
It was pure luck.
Yeah.
Incident. Yeah. And look, the amazing thing was within months, I'd quit my job at the florist and I had a full time job there. At that point, I think it was at that point, I went to my grandfather and was just visiting him in the retirement home and having a chat with him. And I said, "Papa, I think I've finally found at the age of 30, I think I've finally found, you know, my calling, you know, what the thing I'm meant to be doing in the world, you know." He, of course, being an amazing, fabulous old guy, was always talking to me about, you know, where are you going? What are you heading? What are you up to now, John? Right. And he said, you know, when I told him, you know, he was going to be baking, you know, I was really enjoying baking. He said, "Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Yep. Cool. All right. Yep. Totally get it." And I could see that he was disappointed.
Okay. You
know, I could see that he was disappointed because he had single-handedly lifted our family out of poverty.
Oh dear! Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, his family were like, you know, I guess Scottish immigrants, you know, forced out by the, you know, the whatever the, what were they called, the third clearances in the Highlands of Scotland. Anyway, okay. Forced out by the, you know, the bloody landlords clearing the Highlands to make room for more sheep and less peasants. So my family came out to Australia. Well, that part of my family came out to Australia to escape all that, and were just absolute, you know, farming people. Yeah. So, you know, with no money, you know, he'd gone and got a job at the bank.
Okay.
And, you know, as a, you know, junior, you know, clerk, you know, just a, you know, not, you know, just the lowest level of the bank. And he had, in his time, he had worked his way up through the bank to become a bank manager, you know. And back in the day, you know, when he was a bank manager in the 40s and 50s, that was like, you know, that was having made it. That was incredible, you know. So he was he'd lifted our family out of poverty and out of a sort of fairly hard working farming life. So.
Right.
He sent my father off to the poshest private school in Melbourne, and you know, and I was signed up to go to that school as well at birth. So there was this expectation, you know, sure, that the family had finally dug itself out of, you know, out of its, you know, impoverished roots, and we were going to finally, you know, be something in the big city of Melbourne. Anyway, so you could sort of sense that, you know, I'd taken this retrograde step, backwards in the, you know, in the ascent of the family name, the good family name. So I think I can do amazing things here, Papa. I think it's going to be something where I can really find the expression of who I am. And he said, "Yeah, look at it, John. It makes absolutely. I'm really happy for you. Actually, it makes perfect sense because, you know, that's actually where our, and the reason I'm looking the way I'm looking is because that's where our family comes from." So, and then he proceeded to tell me something of our family history I had no idea about. No one had ever spoken about it because, again, it was, you know, referencing the past we were trying to leave behind. And that was the fact that, you know, half of the entire family of Reed's, they'd always been bakers.
Oh, wow.
So he proceeded to tell me, you know, about, you know, Uncle Roy Raggett, who had the biggest bakery in Bendigo. And then he told me about, you know, a couple of other uncles of his that had, you know, Scotch oven bakeries around Ballarat and Colac and all these small country towns around Victoria. So we, you know, I've got this, you know, massive, you know, like this huge family baking history. I had no idea about until that conversation.
Wow, my goodness.
It had never been referenced at all in my presence.
Wow.
So I thought, my God, isn't that, you know, what of it? It's obviously not coincidence, you know?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Well, and they were doing this in Australia as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. That's so neat. Well, because my family came over, came to Canada from Romania, and the same kind of thing. A couple of the old aunts and uncles might talk about the trip over, you know, because they were, say, 10 years old when they came over, but there was no way, nobody mentioned anything about what was going on back home, that's for sure. You know, and it was all farmers, right? And so I haven't had any raised eyebrows about what I do, but certainly my trajectory was, you know, you have to get the good government job and something with the suit and the tie and corner office was sort of the thing you aspire to, because as long as you're not a farmer or an auto mechanic, you know, because they knew how, that was the family, they knew how hard that work was. So it was just, you know, just do something that's not so bloody hard, but it didn't work for me either.
Well, look, you know, there is that thing, and, you know, most of the people you've had on the podcast talk about it, you know, which is just that, I don't know, there's something about baking that is just, you know, working with your hands, but also, you know, you're not totally switched off either in your head department. So there's some amazing synthesis. I'm really not going to be the best person. I think Josie or, you know, one of the other people you've had on, I've heard some really good descriptions of this, and I'm not going to be able to ping it, but there's some beautiful, you know, something about, you know, thoughtful manual work that just ticks all the boxes for us as humans.
You bet. Well, and what I'm really finding, as well as the reaction that people have to our work, is like none other as well, right? And the, you know, the customers that are buying the bread or buying the baking, it's just there's a joy and a connection there that's really, really great. And you know, this is the only thing that I've done like it. You know, so I can't put myself in the shoes of another craftsperson or another artist or something like that, but it's certainly this thing we do is certainly fun from that perspective. Like, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. So I know the map of Australia kind of, and so like, I know you're in Victoria, right?
Yep.
Where Melbourne is the major city.
Yep.
But so how close are you to Melbourne then, or sort of where, What kind of a town is the bakery in?
So just a little geography lesson. So sure. For a long time, Melbourne was the capital of Australia.
Yes,
like you know, it was a much bigger town for most of the early days of colonization than Sydney, for instance.
Right.
You know, Sydney languished because there were the Blue Mountains and there was only so much arable land. So Melbourne actually grew and grew and became the industrial and, you know, the heart of Australia until the 1920s, when we decided that actually the competition between Melbourne and Sydney wasn't a good thing, and we created, like, you know, the Brazilians created Brazilia, that we came up with this really strange place called Canberra,
right,
which
yeah.
we, you know, became the seat of, you know, political life in Australia, and that that took the heat off the competition between Sydney and Melbourne a bit. We're still a little bit competitive, but it's, you know, So Trentham, the little town, it's a tiny rural town about an hour's drive out of the centre of Melbourne, so it's not now very far from the outskirts of Melbourne, because Melbourne's this big sprawling megalopolis, you know, millions of people. but we're lucky. We've sort of got a small, we're up in the hills, we're slightly elevated, and there's sort of a natural barrier to too much more growth in the direction that we are from Melbourne.
Gotcha.
So we're far enough away at the moment that we're not feeling that, you know, we've got, Trentham was, you know, always has been a spud growing town. So
okay.
The climate is absolutely beautiful for potatoes. We have incredible rainfall. It's just the right temperature regime for growing spuds really well. So Trentham was an Irish spud growing village,
sure.
Basically. And it, so it was, you know, supplying a lot of Melbourne with spuds. So potatoes were, you know, potatoes have always been part of Trentham and Trentham life. So, yeah, Trentham had its heyday, I guess, when the railway came through.
Okay.
And it we could ship, you know, thousands of tons of potatoes down to Melbourne and, you know, supply the market down there. And it's always, you know, the other thing about Trentham is it's got the most beautiful, you know, rich, deep volcanic topsoil. So it's like it's 12 feet deep or something like that.
My goodness.
The topsoil in Trentham is this beautiful chocolatey, reddy brown color, and it's just, you know, you can grow anything, you know. You can grow, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, how well things grow there. So, that meant that we, you know, we were a prosperous, you know, growing village for a long time. And then, of course, we went through rural decline because the pressures of corporate agriculture, industrial agriculture started to dig their claws into the Trentham community. And we had, you know, a shocking, awful corporate player called McCain's. McCain's
are
part of, I think, Unilever or, you know, Unifoods,
yeah.
Or one of those mega, you know, global players. Anyway, McCain's took over all the contracts and drove the farmers, spud farmers, the small farm, spud farmers in the ground. It was get big or get out. You know, we lost, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, we lost all our spud farmers. So, you know, we now the landscape is just has gone to pasture and people do cows and stuff like that. But they, but there are very few spud farmers left in our community, which is
a
really sad thing, given how beautifully fertile the area is and how it really should be part of the food bowl for Melbourne. It's now mainly the trend for the time that we've been there for the last 15 years with Redbeard has been that we've had a lot of retirees coming out of Melbourne and buying up large farming tracts and sort of popping a house on there and getting one of the local farmers to mow and you know, put, you know, do some hay or, you know, do something like that. But essentially they keep it mowed so they have a nice view out of their lounge room window, you know. And that's all the use that the land actually, you know, some of the most valuable land close to Melbourne for farming is just, you know, now not being used at all.
Yeah.
The prices, of course, the prices now with that pressure just aren't, it's unaffordable for farmers to actually be there. So we really, you know, you must know this story, but, you know, it's just around cities there hasn't been adequate provision and protection of farming land, you know, and food bowls around major cities. There just hasn't been the town planning that there needs to be to safeguard the, you know, the food production for the city, you know, and that's been part of the whole global movement that is, you know, we now get a hell of a lot of our food down from Queensland, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 miles, like you get most of your food from bloody California.
Exactly.
You know, our system is, you know, just a disgrace, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can relate to that for sure because when I was in Montreal for the Taste of Grain this year, there was a guy talking from Toronto, and he was talking about the green belt around Toronto. There's, you know, which sounds similar to the green belt around Melbourne. And he said that, yeah, like 30% of the top soil in Canada is around Toronto, and it's all going. I was driving through there last year, and it's exactly that. It's put a big house on a tract of land, put a, you know, just keep the lawn cut or the hay cut, and that's it. And this fellow was working really hard to try and grow good corn for Massa. That was his thing. But it's like just to keep those farms in production, so they just didn't get paved over or turned into an acreage. It's always the nasty patterns that seem to repeat, but yeah.
Well, I guess it's that all the drivers are wrong, So we've got the commodification of food such that farmers are not, paid, enough to actually make land that is on the urban fringes actually, it's all the economic incentives are for, sell the land off for development.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no incentive to keep farming in, in these areas. So farming, farmers are pushed out, and intergenerational, the whole intergenerational thing where farmers, don't want their kids to get into farming because there's not there's no money in it. And there's, all the drivers that our government, no doubt your government, have put in the agricultural sector, are all totally wrong at the moment.
Yeah. So the climate around there is great for potatoes. How is it for wheat? Are you able to source a lot of local grains?
Well, we're just getting there, interestingly enough. I had the absolute honor and pleasure to get over to the grain gathering in 2016.
Yeah, right on. Yeah,
WSU with Steve Jones and the gang, and that was just amazing. I had there were five of us Aussies who went over to that event together, and we had just the best time. I travelled around a bit as well while I was there and visited, Bryn up at Saskatoon, of course, and got down to San Fran and hung out with Josie and went and saw Chad and did a lot of stuff and also in the same trip I actually went. I was flying all over the place, I got over and spent time over at Elmore Mountain as well. So,
oh my gosh, that's a big trip.
Yeah, so hanging out with those guys and also Randy, as well. So I sort of picked the eye. I mean, I don't get to travel enough, and I sort of went to the people and places. Oh, I've also got it's something I've wanted to do for my entire baking life. I got to go and hang out with Dave Miller as well.
Oh,
that
wow.
Was just,
good for you.
That was just, yeah, that's like going to the, that's like if you're a religious, that's like, going to Mecca or going to, the source of all good
exactly.
in the world. Yep. So actually hanging with Dave and, eating porridge at his breakfast table after a big shift was, baking and shaping and stuff. And I did actually was there for a couple of days with Byron, from Vancouver Island. So
exactly.
Yeah. So, it's just, amazing time to just meet all of the people in your North American, scene at the grain gathering and just, just be, really pampered and looked after and spoiled by you all. So, it was just the most amazing time. And, at the grain gathering, of course, I listened to, the amazing gospel of Dr. Steve, which is, all about the idea of, finding the right wheat varieties to grow in every local region everywhere. At the time, he was developing a strain of wheat based on Uhland and a couple of other varieties to grow the first wheat, I think, that had ever been grown in Alaska. So that was a project he was working on because there were bakers up in Alaska who were sick of importing and they wanted to, they knew that, wheat could be grown a long way north given, the Uhlands and a couple of the other, far northern Scandinavian varieties, that had been done for a long time. So I knew that basically after seeing what Dr. Steve was up to, that, you know, the project was to actually find the heritage varieties and the newly bred varieties that would actually work for each locale. So I knew there would be wheat varieties. When I got back to Australia, of course, I found there were wheat varieties that were grown in and around Trentham. So since then, of course, the project has been to try and, get those out of the gene banks and grow them out and start to actually work with them and go through the incredibly long, this is a decade-long process, right, of actually finding what works, from tiny test plots and bulking up and then, getting enough to make a loaf of bread and seeing does it have flavor, because that's the whole driver and that's the point of the bread lab, is to actually take all the varieties, that might work in that part of, Skagit Valley and actually see what actually tastes awesome, and that was the huge eye-opener, of course, was making bread out of varieties like Redeemer, which is, not a heritage variety, but a fairly old variety out of Poland. And it's just got the most amazing flavor. That was the most amazing eye-opener, is, hanging out with Blair and with Randy and using Redeemer.
Yeah.
And just, as a whole grain, wholemeal flour, milled with Andrew's beautiful, new American stone mills, which just are incomparable in terms of the quality of the flour that they're producing. To actually make bread out of Redeemer that's been milled properly was just, it just set the bar so, stratospherically high for me, suddenly realized what the goal was, where I could start heading, and it just opened up the entire world for me. So yeah, that grain gathering experience was fundamental in my experiences, as who I'm trying to be now. Yeah,
right,
in terms of the baker.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, and do I understand it right that you're starting, you're part of this grains event that's going to be happening in Australia this year?
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough. It's a movable feast. So
okay,
we have our own grain gathering.
Okay,
that's New Zealand, Australia, and sort of Asia, and we meet every year, and it's always at a different bakery. So someone puts their hand up each year. It's a very loose affiliation. There's no one in charge.
Okay,
so it's a bit of a shocking mess, but it's also just the most beautiful, organic synthesis, and it just works so well because it's just millers, bakers, farmers all getting together and just hanging out and a hell of a lot of unstructured conversation and a hell of a lot of just playing with dough.
Yeah.
So it generally isn't talking heads sitting, up the front of a lectern and telling you how it's meant to be. It's a much more democratic, dispersed, open conference sort of style.
Right.
Thing. So we've been doing it for maybe 5 or 6 years, I'm thinking, but yeah, I put my hand up and said, I'll do it this year. So it's going to be at my joint this year. So
awesome.
Yeah. Feel free to come, Mark.
Okay.
So I'll just do a quick spruik. So it's on from the 6th to the 9th of October.
Uh-huh.
Tickets went online on the 1st of July, and we've sold over half the tickets already, and they're selling like hotcakes. So I think we're going to have an amazing event. We've got Dr. Steve coming over to the event. We've got Grayson Gill from Bellegarde coming over for the event because I really like Grayson. He's just a fabulous human being. And so we've got Grayson coming over, and we've got Kimberly Bell, who organised the UK Grain Lab over the last 2 years. They've had two UK grain gatherings, essentially called the UK Grain Lab, and Kim has organised both of those at her bakery in Nottingham. And so I went over in November and, hung out with, Sheena and with, Joe from Right Rye and all the guys in the UK sort of scene. We all hung out together. It was just the most. It was another just, you know, amazing event. In fact, in some ways, you know, Kim's event actually almost, I shouldn't say this, should I? Almost eclipsed Dr. Steve's beautiful, you know, grain gathering, just because we've moved the goalposts. I mean, it's such a creative, growing sphere of, you know, human endeavor at the moment, because we're, you know, at Kim's event last year in October, there was a really big emphasis on population wheats.
Okay.
So there's a real drive in the UK that is also exists in the US, but it's fairly embryonic, although some people have been doing land race stuff and population wheats there for a while. But we're actually having, yeah, we've got a, yeah, I guess in France there's been an ongoing, you know, understanding of the point of population and land race varieties. We've got an amazing woman, Delphine Sicard, coming over from INRA in France, the agriculture department there, and she has been working with peasant farmers and land race varieties and baking, you know, peasant sourdough. So we're going to learn a whole lot about she's been doing a lot of work on the microbial diversity of sourdoughs in that region, and so it's going to be an amazing thing as well. But yeah, certainly at Kim's UK Grain Lab, there was this, I got the chance to meet an amazing human who sadly died at the start of the year, and that was Professor Martin Wolf, and he developed this amazing thing called YQ population, which is been grown all over the UK, and it is a population wheat that he developed based on a whole lot of heritage and ancient wheat varieties that for Y stands for yield and Q for quality. So he selected and then over many years actually crossed, you know, a whole lot of them and then let them develop in the field. So the YQ population wheat is just this amazing indigenous UK thing now. You know, it's this beautiful, beautiful wheat that has just got incredible genetic diversity. And the thing about population wheats that is really important to understand is they're climate proofed. So in this world where, you know, we've got, you know, bloody Boris and bloody Trump, you know, taking us to hell in a handbag, we've got this, we've got a, you know, future and climate proof ourselves. And one of the ways of doing it is population wheats, because within them they contain a huge amount of genetic diversity, which will actually cope with, you know, major changes in climate. And in fact, it's the way humans have traditionally done wheat. So if you go to, you know, Turkmenistan or Turkey or down to, you know, Abyssinia or any of these ancient cradles of wheat development, human wheat evolution, you find these population landrace wheats that have survived ice ages, have kept going through, you know, multiple climate, major climate, not catastrophes like the one we're creating ourselves, but, you know, major events. So and that's the way wheat and humans have survived together, these climate changes, is by having incredible genetic diversity, which allows for, you know, resilience, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
Human, you know, wheat and human resilience, you know,
yeah,
in the face of climate change.
I don't recall hearing the term population wheat before. I've heard land race quite a bit.
Well, I guess
what's the population, the difference?
Well, the population part of it is to distinguish, you know, it from the traditional land races. So land race is probably harking back to peasant communities and what they've done to produce something that is very localized and very very diverse, whereas a population wheat is a newer term to, I guess, distinguish it as a non-traditional, so a newer development. So Professor Martin Wolf has, with colleagues in Scandinavia particularly, has come up with this idea of population wheats, and they are, I guess, a little bit more deliberate in their genesis.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. Yeah, I'm probably not actually using the correct
terminology. That's okay.
Because I am talking a little bit outside my sphere of actual real knowledge, but this is some of the stuff I accumulated at the UK Grain Lab and spending time on Martin's farm with him and talking about, you know, how he developed it and what it's about.
Right on. Well, this is like when I heard Dr. Steve talk about only using the heritage grains isn't going to be enough, right? Like, you've got to keep creating, you know, do good breeding, do good observation, creating new, the new varieties. And so it makes a lot of sense for sure.
Look, it might not make sense to the purists who, I mean, there's a whole fad, particularly in America now, for, you know, heritage varieties.
Oh, yeah.
So, But that certainly is not the end goal, you know. So it's not the end game, you know. It really is. It's been an important step, you know, to actually, you know, to put Sonora on a pedestal is a really damn good thing, because it's a beautiful, very, very old wheat variety, and it needs to be understood that it has this incredible history. But to see that as the, you know, as the end game, I think is potentially short-sighted in terms of climate change. But also, I agree with, you know, you and Dr. Steve, is that I think actually, you know, wheat breeding is a very human activity. It is not at its fundamental level, it is not scientific. In terms of modern,
I know what you're saying.
You know, it's not like CRISPR. It's not like gene editing. It's not like GM. It's a very, very ancient human activity of wheat breeding. It's a craft. It's something that is not, you know, it's not in the sphere of industrial agriculture, actually, fundamentally.
Right.
And it's important to distinguish it from all the shit that's going down now with CRISPR. You know, we are going to get some monstrosities because we have, you know, the damn US, you know, Agriculture Department, we have the Canadian Agricultural Department, we have the Australian Agriculture Department, hell-bent on supporting all the latest, you know, gene editing, you know, CRISPR stuff, so that, you know, we can, you know, save the world. They're still stuck in the Green Revolution mentality that science will get us out of the shit that science has created.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, as a reformed scientist myself, I can say that is bollocks. You know, it's absolute rubbish that we, you know, we put our faith in science, you know, to get us. I mean, I have to say, you know, fundamentally, I love science. At its fundamental level, science is just about curiosity and exploring where curiosity takes you. So I don't have anything against science fundamentally. What I have is a problem with, you know, the bloody corporate industrial use of science to set their greedy bloody agenda. Sorry about all the swearing, but
you know. No, that's okay. I'm right with you. It's like the same thing, and then patent it and continually sell it back to farmers instead of just letting the process happen the way it has for thousands of years.
Yeah, and it's those, you know, that we have to. I mean, it's really important to say that, you know, those big three major, you know, agrochemical companies, you know, that now is Bayer, and, you know, has bought up Monsanto, and the other couple of global players are absolutely, you know, they have you know, I love the work of Fanana Shiva, the Indian activist. She's an amazing woman, and she talks about the damage that those big players have done with their, with their save the world, green revolution, in inverted commas stuff. They have actually just trashed the bloody planet and run roughshod over fabulous, peasant and localized agricultural, solutions to the growing food to feed humanity. Yeah. So, and they're supported all the way by our governments, and that really stinks. So we need a fundamental political change, in agriculture and food production as much as, any other sphere of, right. life,
Yeah, yeah. So with all of the work you've been doing and everything that you've been learning and organizing and connecting with people, what's the big goal for you right now? What's the thing that you're trying to accomplish in Trentum?
Well, getting everyone together for this grains is gathering is feels to me like, that's where we've got to, find the new path. So, and we've got to find solidarity, and we've got to get rid of competition, and we've got to find ways to work together that are not based on the shitty competitive capitalist model, that has dominated our lives for the last couple of hundred years. We've got to find collaboration, and we've got to honour, food sovereignty. We've got to, this amazing, backlash of people in, first world and a whole lot of, peasant farmers around the world coming together to try and to battle the corporate agricultural political complex. So we've got to just and that's about talking to each other, and it's about meeting at around the shaping table and having I think the shaping table it can be unless you look. Brings me back to, back to a really fundamental decision I made many years ago, and that was that my first bakery I had back in Melbourne itself was just me as a solo operation, and I just got bored with my own company.
Right.
So,
I can see that for sure.
ever since I've endeavored to just employ really good people and have a bakery that is big enough to employ a good, comfortable number of people, and have so that I'm not doing it in a silo.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And so trying to collaborate and trying to cooperate has been my main agenda, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's like since I started this, a year and a half ago, when I did, I knew of maybe three events in the world, where folk bakers were getting together and talking and talking about this kind of stuff. And since then, it just grows and grows. Like this is the second time this week I've heard about Nottingham. I'm thrilled to hear about what you're doing this I guess spring for you in Australia in October, and I just think it's great. I think that what's unique about this time is that it's never been easier to talk to other people and connect with everyone. Like look at us, 16 hours apart and we're talking, and that is, I really appreciate it. I appreciate getting your story and learning a bit more about you, but also, your philosophy on things has been an absolute thrill, and I'm so glad you took the time to chat. Yeah,
thanks, Marky. Are you heading over to Main Grains, or because that's on?
I'm not. That's this weekend, and I'm not able to go. No, this
because you're packing up house. Yeah,
I'm packing up house, and I think my to be honest with you, I think my real estate agent might be upstairs right now talking to my wife.
I can see boxes in the background.
So I made it to Montreal this year, and then and now I'm going to Victoria's.
That sounded fabulous.
You know, I think it was the same ethos as what you're talking about with the event in Australia, was that it's, yes, there are people talking, and yeah, there's some targeted topics to discuss, but there's more free time to just talk with people and just hang out and have a coffee or have a beer and chat than there is talks. And I really think that's where the real work gets done. And so, yeah, it was the best. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to do as well. You know?
Yeah.
So when I get settled in BC, I'm going to be filling up my dance card with grain gatherings next year for sure. but for the rest of this year, I'm learning about it from people that attend, kind of thing. You know, to hear how it was. Yep. But I'm not able to see it in person anymore this year. But
yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks a lot. I really do appreciate this. And I'd love to get out to see you. So I'm filling up a big dance card in Victoria. You know, I've got some friends in Melbourne. I'm trying to make new friends. So I'm glad to meet you. And the scales will tip soon, and I'll get out there. So,
well, Mark, we'd love to have you. And it'd be great. Yeah, please come.
Right on. And I'll tell everyone I know about what you're doing in October for sure.
Thank you.
All right, man. Take care. Right. Thanks so much.
And that was John. So much fun. What a really neat guy. And it's so cool talking to him in the evening here, and it was the next morning there, and all of that stuff. I get a kick out of time zones. But, you know, I wanted to mention one thing about when we were talking towards the end of the chat about new grain varieties, and John went on a little bit of a rant or a tirade or a passionate exposition about, you know, things like GMOs and what folks are doing to plants and to science and that kind of thing. Or I have to admit, I don't understand it completely, but what I do know scares the heck out of me. And I just was, when I was re-listening to the talk, I thought about how if anyone can hold up the mirror to us and what we're doing with science and food and plants and introduction of new species and that kind of thing, it needs to be an Australian. Because if you've ever read anything about Australian history or modern history, European settlement history, you will read about people, well-meaning Europeans that settled in Australia in the 1850s and 1860s and 1870s and brought all kinds of species from home that just went wild on the landscape, whether it's plants or animals like rabbits that they thought it would be fun to shoot them, and then there were just like hundreds of millions of them because there were no natural predators, or the cane toads. I think they even made a documentary about the introduction of cane toads into Australia, and like this thing about local ecosystems and just bring things that fit into the local area that they're growing, I think makes a lot more sense than saying, hey, here's something that's for global production. And I think that was a little bit of what John was getting at, and well worth taking that to heart, especially as we get into local products and that kind of thing. I think the bakers that are trying to work with farmers that are working on more, you know, single varieties or varieties that what they call like landrace varieties that fit in a certain space and do well in a certain space and aren't, you know, aggressive and all of that stuff, I think they're on the right track. And I think if we're supporting those folks, I think we're doing the good work. So I hope I'm right with that, because like I say, I'm learning from other people. I don't have the biology background, but it certainly seems to me that a wide, diverse world where there's thousands and thousands of different species does a heck of a lot better than saying there's one type and it's called wheat and it's owned by Monsanto and you have to buy that. So that's, there you go, probably not breaking any new ground here. But it was really inspirational to hear from John and to hear about what he's doing out there, hear about how he's bringing the past into the future and starting his new conference and all of that. And I just hope it goes really, really well for him. I'm going to have links to the Grains Conference and to Redbeard Bakery and John and all of that stuff in the show notes in your app or on the Rise Up website. So check that out for sure. And if you can make it out to Australia, let me know. I'd love to hear how Grains goes in October. So that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I have to get back to tidying up the house because we're showing it tonight, trying to sell the thing. So I got to sign off. But until next week, have a great week. Leave me a review if you can. Share this with friends if you can. But even if you don't, just have a great week. And I'll see you next week. And until then, happy baking.